But we are persuaded all along and all through life we begin to build up this precious identity, which is our part in the game. It's like you're playing black, I'm playing white, or you're diamonds, I'm clubs, or whatever it is, you see. And so we get a tremendous emotional investment in this identity. And it's fortunes on a kind of game, you know, like the old-fashioned snakes and ladders, when you land on a certain square and you have to go back and so on. All this absorbs us. And then finally we discover that the props that we've all put together to constitute this identity are wearing out. And we're not able to keep up this identity. And gradually we get old and we begin to fail. And then there's all this thought that, well, it's too bad, it's all over. And because we've got bamboozled into thinking that that's what was really going on. So, one of the greatest hoaxes in this whole thing is the future. I don't know why I should be giving a whole series of seminars on the future, but it's important to understand thoroughly the nature of hoaxes. Now, when in talking in this sort of way, don't take me too seriously. In all my writing and lecturing, I exaggerate. Because if I don't exaggerate, no one will listen. Because all philosophers who take a moderate tone of voice and say on the one hand this and on the other hand that, and after all we should realize that all points of view should be taken into consideration, one reveres them for their calmness and their fair-mindedness. But when you listen to it all, have they stimulated you? Have they given you a new idea? No. Therefore, to teach in any way philosophy, you have to make outrageous statements. But with the warning to your listeners that you're only doing this for effect, to get a point across, to provoke thought, because my position as a philosopher is not a verbal position. My position as a philosopher is experiential, and not existential, experiential. That is to say, the experience of the ground. And I will take any side, weave all kinds of patterns, but the whole point of doing that is by showing you how various opinions cancel each other out. You can come to the no opinion, to the ground underneath, and experience that, which is as good, if not better, than falling in love. So, but it's important then, you see, to understand that to some extent, you see, this is a hoax. That we believe that the future is what we're responsible for and what we're supposed to live for. And that we say of a thing which we don't think is any good, it has no future. Now, when you contrast that, which is absolute common sense to most people living in the Western world, it's the future we've got to work for. Contrast that with the Indian, Hindu, Buddhist idea of time, wherein they feel that in the course of time, everything falls apart. And that therefore, there is nothing to be hoped for from the future. Now, they would say to us, isn't that obvious to you? Because after all, don't you see that all organisms, all entities whatsoever, fall apart in the end? Some go fast, some go slow. What do you mean the future? Individuals all fall apart, eventually whole species fall apart. Something else comes true. But for each thing that you can consider as an entity, as an individual, as a species, its future is death. And then they say to us furthermore, you think of time as a progress, as something like a stairway or an ascending ladder that goes on and on and up and up. Maybe it has bumps in it where it occasionally goes down, but it's like a graph, you know, of a successful business corporation looks like this. See? That's how they want their graph to look. The Hindu says, this, you're absurd. The very thing you use for telling time is round. Don't you see? It just goes round. And so, look at the stars. Isn't everything going round? Aren't the galaxies going round? It is going round and round. It isn't going anywhere except round. And we say to them, oh, you poor Hindus, the trouble with you is that you don't have any technology, you have a terrible economy, most of you are starving, and you think life is just terrible, and therefore you have a pessimistic view of it. Well, that makes them laugh themselves silly. They have a pessimistic view. Well, because the point is, we're not pessimistic, because we know that the whole thing is a hoax. We know who we really are. And you poor Westerners, you're bug-eyed. You rush around with long noses. You have deep-set eyes. And you go poking your noses into everything. You send out missionaries because you are so uncertain of your own opinions that you have to convert everyone else to agree with you. And you're quite mad. But you live for the future. And poor suckers. All you do, of course, by living for the future, is you create a great deal of trouble. Because you think you're involved in a process called history. Now, here comes another the very important matter, history. I've had the most amusing discussions with Orientals. And they have really no sense of history at all. For them, life goes around, and 1 year is pretty much the same as the next year. There are rhythms of birth and death. There are rhythms of rulers and revolutions and this and that, but they don't regard it as having some important progression in it. They have chronicles. At least the Chinese kept chronicles. But keeping chronicles is like keeping a diary or a daybook. It's a very different thing from writing history, where you're trying to make out some sort of sense in the course of events. Chroniclers just keep the records. And the Hindus didn't even bother to keep chronicles properly. So it's practically impossible to establish the date of a document from India, unless it was quite recent. Because every time they re-recited it or recopied it, they'd update the names. Because the king in it was an archetypal king. And every king is an example of the archetypal king about whom the story is told. All these Hindu scriptures are like our fairy tales. Once upon a time. Who knows when? A million years ago? 20 years ago? It's all the same. Because the course of events and the rhythm is cyclic. So, we, on the other hand, from St. Augustine was the real troublemaker. I'm not absolutely sure that the Hebrews had a linear theory of time. It's questionable. They might have had one. Because they did look forward to the coming of the Messiah, to the day of the Lord, they had this apocalyptic idea that they were in such a wretched situation that there was going to come a day when the divine power would intervene in human events and set everything to right, and there'd be a head-knocking session called the Last Judgment, and everybody would be put in order. Well, what St. Augustine did with that, you see, he rejected the cyclic theory of time, not quite so much on account of the day of the Lord, coming at the end of time, but on account of the incarnation. He was somehow fixed on the idea that when Jesus was crucified, that was the one full, perfect, sufficient sacrifice for the sins of the whole world. It happened once. And if time is cyclic, he argued, this would have to happen again and again and again, and that couldn't be. Therefore, there is only one time. One progression of time from the creation of the world through its redemption by the sacrifice of the cross and on to the final judgment. Then time would cease and we should be in eternity. And from this, theologians increasingly began to think about the historicity of Jesus and to emphasize that it was a historical fact and that history, as worked out in the Bible stories from the creation through the fall to the doings of Noah and Abraham and the captivity of the Israelites in Egypt and the giving of the law by Moses, all this was worked out as being the mighty acts of God which revealed the divine pattern for the course of human events. And the funny thing is that although many, many historians living today are not Christians and not Jews and don't believe in anything of that, they still think of history as a significant momentum towards progress, something that our children's 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 children are going to get. We all suffered and lived for them, but you're going to inherit this goodie down the end of the line. Now, we really don't know and can't talk about progress unless we know where we're going and are making progress towards that desired object. But most people involved in what they call progress haven't the faintest idea where they're going. I have found increasingly that businessmen and military men are astoundingly impractical. They just don't know what they want. They think they know. I had a long discussion with the Air Force strategic people, and they asked me and some other philosophers, what is your basis for moral behavior? So I pulled their legs and said, the basis for my moral behavior is pure selfishness. A very practical selfishness. I said, of course, I am talking like this because you're all hard-headed people. I'm not going to give you any sentimentality and stupid stuff about love and so on, because you face reality. You're a military man. And you have to see that the United States of America, as a collective selfishness, is properly looked after. Now, I said, of course, in my own personal life, when I'm selfish, I'm not too crude about it. I don't run around hitting people over the head and telling them, gimme, gimme, gimme. I pretend like I'm public servant, that I'm out for their best interests and all that sort of thing, but that's camouflage. So then I said, now, the only trouble about this is that to be effectively selfish, you've got to answer two questions. The first is, what do you want? And the second is, what do you mean by yourself? Well, you know, that just pulls the carpet out from under everything. Because, what do I want? Well, if I answer as a kind of a sensible human being, what do I want in life? The really important thing I have had from the beginning, which is that I'm an incarnation of the ground of being like everybody else. That's the most important thing, because you can't get rid of that. The next thing is, of course, I want food. I want friendship, companions, love, and general singing and dancing and so on. And these are more or less attainable material realities. But then I look at my very wealthy friends who ought to be able to have all these things, especially those who are extremely active in business, and I realize they don't have them. They're the most miserable people. Here, you're a great executive of a very, very important corporation. To begin with, you are drowned in paper. You do nothing but scan paper and make decisions about paper all day. You may be the director of an oil company. You never get within sight of oil, except when you drive your car. Mostly you're surrounded with statistics about oil, finances about oil, and you are smothered in this. And you have to spend almost all day in a wretched office building in a place like New York.